Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Lean Definition Series on the Global Product Management Talk podcast. This is Cindy F. Solomon, delighted to be with you for our 21st episode. I'm here today with Malcolm and also our special guest, Barbara Tian, who is the co-founder of the software product Pongo. And has a deep background in product management. So very excited to have you here. And you can hear more episodes at startupproduct.com as well as at blogtalkradio.com/prodmgmttalk. So, Barbara, would you like to tell us a little bit more about you?
Sure, Cindy. It's a thrill to be here. I'm co-founder and CEO of Pongo. Pongo is a platform for designers, visual professionals, to be able to collaborate with their clients by pointing into pictures. We built this platform out of a fundamental recognition that while the world of computing has leveraged text all this time, images are only now becoming something that we can really build on as the basis for communications. I built my career in networking and telecom. And this was an idea that hit me and frankly wouldn't let go. So I gave up, joined a wonderful co-founder, Alexander Black, and we were off and running. And we had an unexpected parallel in interests and backgrounds. And here we are. We've just started revenue service. You'll find more about Pongo at pro.pongo.com. And I look forward to anyone reaching out to me at barbara@pongo.com.
And that's Pongo.com.
That's correct. Okay. But from the Spanish word poner, which means to put.
Oh, lovely.
Into a picture.
Lovely.
Cool.
Of course, Malcolm.
Yeah, hello, it's Malcolm again. I'm from the Engineer Accelerator. We're a professional training program for hardware engineers, giving them the skills they need to be effective in their career. And so we're continuing this process. This is part of what I actually go through in the program. But we're sort of seeing how it goes beyond hardware and seeing how sort of it can expand out and be sort of more generally applicable. So as I always sort of do with the guests, I have sort of these couple quick sort of questions to start things off, and then we'll go from there. And so the first question is, if you're thinking about a product at a sort of good point, like when you sort of, when it's sort of done to whatever level it's going to be done for this moment, you know, mm-hmm. and this continuous deployment and all sorts of stuff like that. But do you agree with the idea that there's a sort of a finite amount of information that represents the product, represents how to build it, represents everything that's sort of inside it?
I think that's a really good way to think of it.
Okay.
Because as product people, mm-hmm. and to a certain extent scientists, mm-hmm. you want a perfect world. You want perfect information, God damn it. And you are frustrated because you can't have that. It is so much easier to start at the beginning and say, guess what? You're never going to have it.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, your goal is to identify what are the kinds of things that are explorable and knowable, and what are the unknown, the known unknowns.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can know what else you need to test for, what mm-hmm. else you need to break down.
But that's sort of what I'm sort of saying, is that because you're making the product, you're making something physical, you can, this is a theoretical, you may not ever get there, but the idea that any product there is a sort of finite amount of information that sort of represents that.
The problem with assuming that there's a finite amount mm-hmm. of information mm-hmm. is there's a temptation to therefore go get that finite information.
But coming
from the world of hardware, if I may,
it's
really much more straightforward to say there's a finite set of information. Mm-hmm. And coming from telecom, I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
In telecom, it's, in a sense, so easy. Because if you know you're going to make a gazinta that plugs into that goes out,
mm-hmm.
then you know what gender it needs to be.
Yeah.
You know, there are specs for everything.
Yeah.
So you're done.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you're making a piece of software,
mm-hmm.
you know the platform, you know the bandwidth, mm. you know those kinds of things, but there's a whole lot you don't know, and you never will.
And so that's the thing is that, so this is, you know, if you had sort of looking at it from the outside, yes, at the very beginning of the project, you definitely don't know all the stuff you'll need to know to complete things. But it's more just that the idea that you can sort of bound the space.
Yes. And you have to
which you
the
have
space.
To right, because yeah. How else could you scope
and
know
also,
how much resources you need, how much
right.
manpower.
So fundamentally it's imperfect.
Yes.
And when you accept that it's imperfect, it's frankly a little like motherhood. Motherhood, every ambition you have is to be perfect. But a real mother with a real squalling baby mm-hmm. realizes mm-hmm. they're imperfect, mm-hmm. and you're just doing your best.
Yeah, well, I have actually a one-year-old.
So oh, there
I
we go.
Exactly that.
Good for you. So forgive me, it's parenthood, not motherhood.
Right.
But the thing is, you actually have made something by that point, and so so for me, it feels like that. You know, you're getting, you may never get there, like you personally or you and then sort of, but there is a sort of finite amount of information that computer, you could write it out, you know.
That's what you know in hindsight.
Yeah.
We have to define.
But that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yes.
Is that at some point you do know all the stuff. And so
that's yeah. why they have fuck up nights.
Yeah. And so.
I just have to go in. So I met Barbara at a fuck-up night here at the Port Workspaces
yes.
where there were three founders talking about how they fucked up in the past.
Okay.
So.
Very good. So that's the thing is that, I like to think about it in sort of spatial terms. You have this sort of multidimensional space that represents all the information you need to know about that product. The next thing is the question is, within that space, is there a sort of hierarchy of information where sort of lower levels are dependent on higher levels of information? So,
of course.
Yeah, great. Well, this is not necessarily a hard question.
That was a leading question.
It's not necessarily a hard question, but it's not necessarily. So, but that,
let me,
sort of,
let me
a,
elaborate on that.
Good.
As you were describing it, particularly
yeah.
as a
yeah.
true mechanical engineer, civil engineer,
electrical
engineer, a physical guy, if I may
yes,
say,
yes.
I get the physical space reference.
Yes.
Go with that.
Yeah.
A CEO, former CEO of mine, Alan Lefkoff, used to quote a former boss of his who quoted, I don't know, GE, Jack Welch or somebody, referencing the most important skill a product manager has is to nimbly traverse multiple layers of abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
Isn't that great?
Yes.
And
excellent.
I'm not sure if I got the whole quote,
no,
but that's the way
that's
I remember
quote.
It.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I think about it
mm-hmm.
is the ability to zoom in and out mm-hmm. from the capillaries on the leaves on the trees to the tree, to whether it's a deciduous tree or an evergreen,
mm-hmm.
to the forest. Well, actually, no, then there's the wood, the forest, the continent, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then what's deforestation got to do with the ozone layer or with global warming and blah, blah, blah. And then go back again. Because guess what? You were picking the wrong tree.
Well, you're talking about levels of information
and
zooming
that's
in.
That's where you cannot know. And as a product manager, one of the hardest things
mm-hmm.
is you can spec every detail of the gazintas and the gazautas and the weight and the plastic and the color and everything else. And at the end of the day, what really mattered was the substitute that you missed.
Mm-hmm.
And in most cases, in my experience, the products that succeeded and the products that failed had more to do with the environment and the substitutes.
The substitute,
than it did
like you,
the alternative product.
Okay.
And it
well,
wasn't
that
just
was a market issue then.
Well, it wasn't just, yeah, absolutely. It's a larger market issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just the competitor as a substitute to your product. But I'll give a for instance that I don't think is a well, company is still sort of alive. Farallon Computing,
yeah.
which was a pioneer in the Macintosh space.
Yeah.
Apple Computer reached out to them, and I think about 19... it was like the end of the bad old days, 96, 97, something like that. I think 96. Reached out to Farallon Computing and said, look, we've been trying to make this new IR connector for this new 5300 PowerBook. And frankly, it's really a substitute for your phone net connectors.
Mm-hmm.
It'll do Apple Talk over IR. It's really cool, but we can't make it. well, cheap enough. Can you do it? We'll give you the plans. You just make it happen. Mm-hmm. And we said, okay. We killed ourselves to make it happen. I've got to tell you, weekly trips back and forth Silicon Valley. And at the end of the day, first of all, that PowerBook blew up. That was the one that caught fire.
Oh, my God.
And second, really? IR to do local talk? When all you have to do is lean over and plug it in.
The lean definition process would come after the competitive research, would come after the business case has been validated.
Part of my point is that, yes, I agree.
Yeah.
But whatever you learn in that process stays alive. It's not, and that I think is a really valid and tremendously important role of a product manager. Because it may be that you begin a six-month process back at month zero, working on all of that kind of definition, and at month three, some new spec is announced, some new technology changes, something.
Yeah, and so
exactly, yeah.
So part of what this is about, so then that question about the hierarchy is sort of the sort of bridge question to the sort of more sort of expansive thing about which is basically what is at the highest level in the hierarchy. And to be clear, this is about the product itself, the sort of the engineering, you know.
The pre-build before we invest in building.
So as we were saying is that we're focused in, we've sort of looked at the market case and there sort of seems to be something there, and sort of now you're actually trying to figure out what you're going to build that meets that need. And so the question is, when you're thinking about the actual product, you know, whether the website or a computer or hardware or whatever like that, what's the highest level in the informational hierarchy?
I'm not sure if I'm thinking about it the way you do, but I usually start with what is the problem to be solved.
Right. So we're past that. We have
so
all agreed on what problem we're solving.
The problem is going to be solved with this widget.
Yes.
So it's going to be, this is the problem that needs to be solved. What is the widget
we're going to build?
We know we're making a widget to solve
it. Right, exactly.
Then what's the question?
Then the question is,
what is that widget?
Which specific widget are you going to make?
The way you decide what kind of widget to make is by understanding what were the constraints on that problem to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
For example, cost, price.
Mm-hmm.
And cost, therefore margin,
mm-hmm.
Standards that are out there,
mm-hmm.
and expectations from customers that are out there,
mm-hmm.
and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So when you, framing the question of what is the problem to be solved is absolutely critical, but all of those other deliverables and variables are carry forward.
Mm-hmm.
Into that definition of the widget, which is why I brought up this example of this stupid little IR widget, which I suspect was wouldn't it be cool if we had a wireless way to connect to the network?
Mm-hmm.
And true, that would be a really cool way. This is way before Wi-Fi. And Apple, let's remember, was the first one out there, I believe, with mass-scale Wi-Fi devices, with the first, what was it called, the graphite Wi-Fi bridge router dude.
Mm-hmm.
And this was so close, but it just wasn't enough of those pieces.
Yeah, and so that's the thing, is that there's need finding. You know, I separate, you know, need, do you have need finding?
And problem?
Well, but then you find that's basically finding the problem, figuring out what the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that is definitely part of this, you know, you have to have a problem you're solving, you have to know specifically what that problem is.
Right.
But once you've found that problem, you can, there are many, many different potential products you could choose to solve it, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So the question for any company or any team is, which the one are they going to choose?
Well, a lot of the choosing,
I
guess you've already figured out that what I'm saying is that there's a constant, dare I use a big word, there's a constant dialectic of cycling through that process as you narrow it in.
Yeah.
And some of the variables in that process include things that not only consider complete alternatives, but also that consider what you as a company or you as individuals, or you as engineers, are good at.
What your capabilities are,
what your differentiator is.
Sure.
Yeah.
because that unique differentiator is going to carry its way into this product, which is going to give it that magical, unique selling proposition.
And right. So this is actually sort of what I'm getting at, is that the lean definition process was done because I would see people go into projects and be trying to design three different, products at the same time, you know, not one. Right. Or designing something that was, they had these three pieces, but they weren't looking at the whole thing.
Yeah.
And so what this is all about...
And I have horror stories about being at an early mobile startup that I had three teams of engineers doing three different products. And they brought me in to make it into one product. Getting rid of anything. How do I put it together?
A little pro tip for anybody hiring a product manager. One of the first questions they ought to always ask a prospective product manager is, tell me what products you built that were failures, and tell me what you learned.
Yeah.
Because as you ask that question, I know five products
flash to mind. We all have horror stories.
And then those complete surprises of successes that we had no business building. I mean, it breaks my heart. There were some wonderful products that we made that we should not have made. There were products that we made that we never released to market. And as we get together as former Farrellonians, we still talk about Finger, for example. there were some marvelous products that worked 5 years, 10 years.
Well, the timing wasn't right, exactly.
But no, we didn't release it.
Ah.
Yeah. So that's the sort of thing we're trying to do, is that we're trying to get this... So you have this issue where you are not really being clear about what you're making.
It's muddy thinking.
And because, both engineers love to dive down and actually start writing code and finding components and solving the problems that they can see, the known knowns and the sort of fun parts, but that's not a complete product. Mm-hmm. And so what we're trying to do is to figure out a process that will... sort of bring sort of a more complete, bring those unknown issues to the surface, and the unknown unknowns, not even the known known unknowns, it's the ones you don't even know you need to know, that are the showstoppers a lot of times.
Yeah.
And so what we basically are thinking about is trying to look at how to capture the different aspects at this highest level, you talk about levels of abstraction, you're talking about, it's not like you're not maybe at the continent level, but you're at like the tree level,
Certainly.
Where you have thousands of trees you could choose, and you need to figure out which one you're going to do. And so the way I'm sort of thinking about this is, what would capture the different aspects of a product completely? And the way I sort of break it down is to two main things, and some other bits and pieces, of course, but is that you break it down into what the product is, and then what the product does.
Mm-hmm.
And the separator is the sort of the things that don't really change. The sort of, in hardware, it's all the chips and all, or sort of, all the sort of, is there a display or not? Is there a keyboard? Does it connect to the internet? Are things don't really change.
Yeah.
And what it does are all the sort of behaviors. If you hit this button, what happens? It uses the features, the things that it is, and then how do they change? What happens when things happen in time?
I completely agree how vital that is, and that's a terrifically good way to do it, because it also helps you understand, as the product lives over time, that there may be things that it does that are delivered by your company by a different is, by a different generation of the same product.
Yes.
It also helps you keep in mind that what the world of substitutes and alternatives are that are doing the do without being you.
Yeah,
we're adding rock.
And that's, I think, one thing that's is that what you're looking for then is, you can then start breaking down the functionality of your product in a way that you can start to see where the sort of, the modules are that make it up.
The one thing that concerns me, and maybe you've got a way to think about this, is how do you articulate, where in that process do you articulate the architectural structure of the product?
Good question.
I mean architectural as it applies not only to hardware but also to software.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance,
mm-hmm.
in hardware, you might talk about the architectural is in the definition of the product.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to have modules that slide in and out.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to have connector types that mm-hmm. vary or
mm-hmm.
whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
But still is executing the same, does
mm-hmm.
the same function,
mm-hmm.
Whatever. There are also definitions of architecture that allow it to do different tasks.
Mm-hmm.
A Swiss Army knife comes to mind, for
mm-hmm.
example. I think about this a lot, again, coming from hardware into software. And I am very grateful to my technology team, my co-founder and our team,
mm-hmm.
Alex and Hans, and the team, that it really came up with architectural elements to our approach
mm-hmm.
in software that really give us legs
mm-hmm.
in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about the delivery of the initial function. And that delivery of the initial function is what I've got to sell today. And I can't sell what's not on the truck, but it depends on who I'm talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how, in your definition of is and does,
mm-hmm.
you have a way to articulate and understand that. Because oftentimes the customer that's buying the does today
mm-hmm.
doesn't care or understand the larger picture.
And so that's the other thing about the process. This is an internal document for
yeah, yeah.
the team. And so the way I sort of think about it is that there is a this definition gets at some of the architectural stuff, the intrinsic nature of the product and the way it solves the problem
mm-hmm.
implies certain types of architecture. I mean, modularity or portability, for example,
mm-hmm.
is an architectural decision. Is it portable? Then it needs a battery, for example, sort of stuff like that. There's sort of some implied stuff there. And then beyond that, like you said, the is and the does doesn't necessarily have the specific technologies you're going to use. Many different technologies could meet that same is and does. So you take this definition when you're sort of as done as you sort of want to be, or you think when you then map that over into the specific technologies you're going to use in the architecture phase. For in my process that
mm-hmm.
we do in the Engineer Accelerator, there is a specific architecture phase
mm-hmm.
where you take this the functionality, the what it is, what it does, and you map it over and say, here's the specific chips I'm going to use,
mm-hmm.
here's the specific code structures
mm-hmm.
I'm going to use, and all
mm-hmm.
sort of stuff like that.
And how do you cycle back into the definition, the potentials created by those choices made?
Well, exactly, but that's the whole thing, is that the definition process has the engineering team in the room,
mm-hmm.
Or like the head, or you know, they're the engineers are there, going through this process, an iterative process.
Mm-hmm.
So you have certain functionality that you want, like the
mm-hmm.
does,
mm-hmm.
and then you go to the engineer and say, okay, here's what the does, how does that, what is the product that works with that, and then you can say, well, this does is hard, that one's easy, so then you circle back and say, do you really want the hard one? Does that really have to be in there? And then you sort of go back and
yeah.
forth. And part of this thing is about synchronizing everybody together.
Yeah. And then the one hand is things like design for manufacturing,
mm-hmm.
where you start
right.
to anticipate what it's going to take to manufacture,
mm-hmm.
or the software guys start to look at what chipsets the hardware guys want to use and
mm-hmm.
go, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And then there's also the flip side where, oh my God, look at this new system on a chip, and we can do this, and we can do this, and we can
mm-hmm.
do this,
yeah.
and you get system creep, and
yep.
you get design
yeah.
creep.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the thing that's going on there is...
Done all of those.
Yeah. So, but that's the whole thing, is that there's hard work to synchronize everybody together. And your software people have to agree that their needs affect the chip you choose, which affects, and so forth. And so, so that thing about there's a conflict, you want to get those to the surface as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Making that happen, if the chip is really important, then that's a high-level thing, and that choice is a high-level in the hierarchy and should be chosen in the definition, because
mm-hmm.
it's going to affect everything going on down,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes, but other chips are not. It's like, you know, you want just a sort of, you know, resistors and capacitors you don't care about. Design for manufacturer is interesting because generally for me, I call that lower in the hierarchy, mm-hmm. because a lot of times design for manufacturer doesn't change the functionality as much. It just changes the lower levels of the sort of system, you know. Mm-hmm. So you move chips around, or you sort of change things. Yeah. It can, you know, the sourcing, of course,
right.
is one of the biggest things.
That's what I was going to say. That would make
the
difference.
And so what happens, though, is when you get down to lower levels, if there's something that does affect higher levels, you can then have a moment to say, we have a problem, let's jump back up to the definition and work it back through and see what the implications of this change are.
Right.
Because part of the thing is change happens, but the other thing I've seen all the time is that then change gets incorporated completely sort of ad hoc.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's why I think the clear communication and trust mm-hmm. within a product team mm-hmm. is vital, mm-hmm. as well as the permission of senior management to call attention mm-hmm. to problems that are going to come up. Mm-hmm. I think it's in Walter Isaacson's book about Steve Jobs. Mm-hmm. There's a good story about Gorilla Glass mm-hmm. and the original iPhone, and how essentially they were trying to spec something that didn't exist, mm-hmm. and what the compromises they had to make in order to have it happen. Mm-hmm. And that is so common when you're pushing something to push the bounds mm-hmm. of what's out there. As a little tiny company, you might be able to do that, particularly mm-hmm. in software, particularly if you've got a team that is very cutting edge from a development perspective. In hardware, it's much harder, but once you're a company of Apple stature, mm-hmm. I mean, they leveraged, they were almost out of cash at that point, let's remember. But they managed to get away with that, pulling largely on their credibility mm-hmm. of style and pizzazz and so on, and mm-hmm. and pure personality. And, you know, there's a lot of people still carrying the wounds from that. But not everybody is Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a lot of people who seem to think they are.
Mm-hmm.
And they
want
have to
be.
To separate their egos from the goals of the team.
Yeah.
And that's so vital, which comes back to the earlier conversation mm-hmm. about trust and goals.
Yeah,
and
part of this thing is that, you know, again, if you're bringing a team together or you have a team, this process about getting people it makes people talk to each other.
Yeah.
And it's not one of those things where you can go off and, you know, what you basically do is you go around and you then the product manager will then take all the information they collected and organize it. We have a format, and, you know, there's a bunch of stuff. And there's holes that appear, like the things that aren't settled yet.
Right.
You mark those in red or, like, make them really obvious. And the idea is that you keep going around the loop until that amount of red is reduced to an acceptable level.
Right.
And if there's a lot of it there, you can't move forward.
Right.
And you can't move forward. And so you can basically, what you then have is a reflection back to the team about the state that they're in.
Right.
And then you get to this point about, you know, is it worth banging on about this, and we're not going to move until some resolution happens.
I think it's very important from a process perspective that mm-hmm. while it's critical to identify where the blocks are, mm-hmm. It's also important as you identify those, identify a path to resolve them.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is identifying a person with responsibility to mm-hmm. solve them, but also giving them the authority or letting them identify what additional authority they need in order to be able to resolve those. So often, in organizations, it's so easy to just, I need some accountability here, and you throw a person at it. But you don't give them the tools, the people, the authority, mm-hmm. or a clue as to how to go forward.
Yeah.
And those people need mentoring, mm-hmm. they need guidance, mm-hmm. they need you know, creativity, room for creativity to get past those kinds of blocks.
Yeah, and basically what this thing does is that, you know, we're talking about product managers not having direct authority a lot of times to tell people what to do. So what you can then do is you can say, you know, you can basically point out a conflict between two parts of the team and say, you guys have to figure out the resolution of this, you know. And then if then there's always an issue about whether they want to solve that, and that gets into team dynamic stuff.
But they were involved in this process from the beginning.
Yes.
So it was a collaboration, and they had buy-in. It's not the product manager pushing it on anyone or deciding what the product needs to be. It's everyone has come together with their expertise.
Yeah.
You
and
know,
so,
if
yeah.
we can
ideally
see that point for a moment, I think that's really important because it's going to vary in every organization.
Yes.
Who has responsibility?
And who's going to be at the table for this?
Well, who's going to be at the table, but kind of whose responsibility is it to define this product? I would argue that the notion that it's not the product manager's responsibility to define it, but they're part of the team. I kind of disagree, actually. At the end of the day, when you have a team moving forward, you do need a path to be able to say, to have someone be the product owner, right? To say, is this or is this not part of the widget? And the product manager may be the one set up to fail. The product manager may be the one set up to make those decisions. They have to be able to know what are the kinds of decisions that they will just make. And what are the ones that they're like, I think this is right, but I want some. I want to know who my superior is to agree with me or not. And that's why most traditional large-scale company organizations define gate reviews, as they call them at Nortel, or you know, milestone reviews, as they call them at Apple, or whatever else, that have these moments that are defined to have a defined conclusion and then a go, no go, or a go back and figure this out, or whatever else. And I think that is actually really critical, and it's really critical because it really does give the product manager the authority to be making those decisions. And it's kind of like remodeling a house or anything else. There are a gazillion little decisions that you never knew were important. And engineers are making to, you know, how code will operate. And all of a sudden you have this fabulous thing, and what do you mean you can't store it to disk? What the hell? What are you thinking?
Yeah. So I think so I agree. I mean, I think that if you're in a situation, I mean, part of what this is about is that many companies are different and people's...
Yeah,
and
exactly
if a product manager has authority to say, this is what we're doing, great, you know. But it also means that you can have some path to... You can't just sort of you have some path to dealing with a situation where you don't have as much authority. You can say we're trying to solve this problem. We have this issue, but we can't move forward because what they do control is whether the definition is done or not.
Yeah.
You know,
the good enough part.
And so they can say I'm not going to say the definition isn't done until this is resolved. You know,
right.
And so at least that gets people. It can start. You know, it can help that process along.
That's why I think product managers, you know, in terms of personality and so on, social engineering and, you know, interpersonal dynamics and those kinds of skills are vitally important in a product manager. I have known many a product manager who's more of an authoritarian. I am a cattle catcher. Put me on the train, put me in the front of the train, and I'll get everything goddamn off that tracks, and we're moving forward full speed because I'm fast. Okay, that's cool. And there may be some kinds of things
where
that's the kind of person you want.
And people get out of their way and let them make
their mistakes
and fail.
Right. And so it's going to depend on a company and what you're trying to accomplish and what you need. My personal style in terms of what worked for me was not always, let's all kumbaya and get all in a circle and agree that we all want to do this. I don't mind being out in front and saying, guys, this is what customers want because I've been out there. And that's the authority vested in me. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's any kind of leadership, any kind of having everybody follow. They got to follow. And that following mostly comes from credibility. And ability to communicate and ability to bring human people in the same direction.
And so this is what this is about, is that this is a process that One of the big reasons why I did it is I wanted to say, at the beginning of a project, you want the most communication between the various different sort of people. You know, and I was doing it in terms of clients, but I want to talk to them the most right at the beginning, because all this stuff comes up, you know, that was there, but just never, you know, that was never explicit.
Where the hell were you when I was trying to figure this out?
And also, one of the results of this process is a lean document, or a light footprinted document with pseudocode
describing what we all agree to. One part of it, so it's basically how you then capture this information.
You don't have an agreement if it's not documented.
Yeah. So how do you capture this information? So we talked about what it is, what it does. And the way you capture it is, the way I break it down is, and one of the things I'm interested in is actually other things that are really useful in this regard. But it's basically, you know, flow diagrams, so block diagrams basically, which show you how things flow. It could be information, it could be power, it could be any signals, that sort of stuff like that. Whatever the flow is, and that's actually capturing behavior. It's what it sort of does. Sure. Then there's a sort of characteristics list, basically, which every block in your block diagram will have things that are important about it. You know, it has to be a color screen. It has to be, you know, CYMK or whatever it is, colors, you know. Sort of. Yeah. But that's basically a hierarchical list, you know, based from the, sort of going from the product level down into the different you know, blocks, basically.
In Telcom, we used to also do packet flow diagrams, same idea.
Yeah, but the idea is that there's characteristics of those, and they're not, it's a human readable format, so it's just, but whatever you think is important about this part, write it down. And then the third part is about sort of capturing sort of what it does, sort of other aspects of sort of behavior, basically, is sort of states and events, sort of state machines and events, and then sequences, which are like basically pseudocode, you know. So pseudocode is, you know, a sequence of things, but with logical, you can put logic into it. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not, so it's basic, so you end up with sort of something that's code-like, but without syntax. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, it's again, human readable. Mm-hmm. And again, it's what the team understands. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that you're trying to, ultimately, what I'm trying to do is make everything you can put this whole document into a text file. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten pretty close.
Although I would argue that it might be enhanced by pictures.
So the display, the one thing that's harder to do is the block diagram, of course, and so in a text file. So right now I don't have it. So
we'll have to use your software.
But that's the thing is that so it's more that it can be stored as a text document and maybe viewed in different ways. But there's definitely the picture stuff and all those sort of things are very, you know, that's, if that's appropriate. I mean, if you're dealing with a mechanical or an ID-based thing, you're going to have sketches.
Yeah.
Or at this
you
high
are
level.
Such a hardware guy.
I am. What else can I be?
It's irritation,
like,
right.
So that's just, you know.
But visuals are key at any point with
software
as well.
The reason I'm sort of laughing about that, because I'm reflecting back on my own experience and my own process through this, and that, yes, I've always been working with hardware guys, and in many ways what came of the ideas for my product came from that experience working with engineers and concluding it all goes into a text document, and yet so much of what we were talking about in terms of what we were ultimately delivering in networking you have the idea of network maps, right? And the network maps connect the logical to the physical. And as I suddenly looked around at the physical world around me when I was in front of a computer all day long, and I'd just gone through a home remodel, I was a lot of the same kind of thing. I'm like, holy cow, where is the logical map to the physical world that I'm looking at, and why can't I do that? Mm-hmm. And why am I limited to text to do that? Mm-hmm. That's crazy, especially when I've got this thing in my hand that can take a high-resolution picture. And it's a computer. Mm-hmm. Why can't I connect every pixel, arbitrary pixel range in that picture and connect it to anything, anywhere on the web? Mm. Why can't I do that? Well, of course, That kind of discussion is meaningless when I talk to designers, for example.
Right.
What is she railing
they,
about?
They can't.
They don't understand.
They don't have
but
a tangible.
Where,
yeah.
This is, in fact, the context.
Yeah, and so to be clear, is that I'm not saying it has to be. I'm not saying it has to be text.
No, of course not.
And so, you know, for me, I'm actually at visual stuff, as you might
know.
Is where I'm where I like it. And so for me, the block diagram stuff is extremely powerful because not only because as a recording device, but as a discovery device. When I'm making my block diagrams, I am figuring out the product.
Right, I understand. Yeah. And in fact, I think it's really important to think about abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
That's why that idea of traversing multiple levels of abstraction is important, because when you abstract a complex concept into a box, and then a box into words, which are fundamentally abstract, and you can go back and forth, and then you go back to that physical of what kind of plastic, and what the feel of the plastic is, and how it's texturized or whatever else, you are going back and forth across those different worlds.
Mm-hmm.
What was our revelation in terms of our product was recognizing that photography, images, were in fact a new and vital part of the way we deal with, way we can express and communicate in our digital world today. And that photographs have a way of capturing things. The danger of photographs is they capture things in such a reality that we wrap our little minds, we get literal. We get very literal. And that is the value of being very abstract and keeping it abstract, because it forces you to consider all possible options that are described by that abstract concept of, you know, a square versus a rectangle. There is a difference, right? And, you know, when you start talking about trees, are we deciduous? Are we evergreen? Are we redwood? Are we redwood sequoia? Are we redwood sequoia, you know, blah, blah, blah.
And this is actually, we had a big discussion about the language that we're that you use.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest things for me is about that this process creates the language that the team will use to talk about the project.
Yeah,
the product.
That's right.
You know, and you know, and they have to agree. So the specific words you use may not they don't matter too much, but some are more descriptive and some are less. Yeah. And then you have to decide at some point what you're going to call it. You know?
At times, I've built lexicons.
Yeah,
right.
Lexicons. Super.
You might
helpful.
Have to for each product, and so going through this process also creates a team dynamic across functions. And therefore enables the product manager to be more effective.
So I want to wrap up just a few things. But one thing you mentioned a little bit a while ago was feature creep.
Yeah.
You know, and so one of this does is because you go through this process at the beginning, and you get down to a level where you're sort of acceptable level of unknown. You say, okay, we're freezing the design, we're freezing the definition, we're done, and then. The way you deal, then what you can do is you can then map that back up to the scope of the project, because every block in there maps certain tasks that someone has to get done.
Mm-hmm.
And that means time and money, basically. Mm-hmm. So one of the things about feature creep is when you have an engineer come up and say, you know, I would love to put this in, this would be great, you can then map that over into the budget and schedule, and does it fit or not, you know?
And sometimes, and this is the part about creativity,
yeah.
I think it's vitally important that everybody in the team have room for creativity, because oftentimes that engineer's aha moment saves time and money, because they have the room to go be creative and say, you know what, instead of using that chipset, if we use this chipset, we not only get this function later, but we can do this now, we'll do it in half the time.
Yeah. And so it could be a positive thing. You know?
Right.
It's not necessarily, but
everyone has to be analyzing for what the time and money.
Yeah, so that's the thing, is that what this process means is that then you can basically take an engineering discussion and convert it into time and budget, and then you can say, and then in both directions, you know, if the founder comes and says, I really want this in there, then you can say, well, we can put it in there, but it'll cost us much more and take this much longer. Do you accept that? And it makes that, it sort of, it controls that process. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. Sometimes you have to change things, but it means that you have a process. I mean, I remember one time I had a feature creep that was literally a 15-second conversation, and it meant that I had, 10 or 20 hours more work to do a month later, And so that's what this is all about. It's not to say that this is the final, it's in stone and you can't change it ever, but that you have a process for changing it. Mm-hmm.
And you have a reflection of what the definition is now, right, that everyone can see.
Yeah.
Maybe the product manager then uses it to roadmap, but roadmap for different audiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, a thought occurred to me as you were describing that sort of, I wouldn't call it a regret, but it was a, if I had to do it over again, mm-hmm, perspective. If I, thinking back as I've had flashes of success and failure all afternoon long, it occurred to me that if I were doing this now as a young product manager, I would start a little private notebook or Evernote or something, mm-hmm, like that starts to capture each product. It's structured. Mm-hmm. It's forced to a structure.
Yeah.
Did this product reach milestone X, and maybe it's never isn't actually release, but you could use release. And then you build a history of your own list of products that you touched, and a debrief. It may be a private debrief. What worked? What didn't work? What would I do differently? What pissed me off? Mm-hmm. What I'm really proud of? Then you can be going back to them again and looking back on that. I never did do that on a structured basis.
Yeah.
I do find there are touchstone products in my history that I'm super proud of, some of which were my company did that I didn't directly do, but at the end of the day did make a difference to my life because it enhanced the value of the company, or frankly it hurt the value of the company. Mm-hmm. And I think as a product manager, the discipline to do that, not in a way that is because your boss told you to, because you have to report and tell the politics to it, but keep it private. Do it for yourself.
It's your own product portfolio.
At the end of the day, you work for your own reputation.
Yes.
And that's incredibly important.
Excellent. Thank you. I think that's a great place to end, and I really appreciate your perspective and insights into
This was fun. Yeah,
product management, as well as into this lean definition process.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking with Barbara Tien, who's the co-founder of Punga.com, which is available at pro.ponga.com, and as well as with Malcolm, and I'm Cindy F. Solomon. Thanks for listening, and review all of these episodes at startupproduct.com, and check out the Engineering Accelerator
at engineeraccelerator.com or on Facebook at Engineer Accelerator.
And we appreciate your feedback. Have a great week.